welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston. My guest today is a man best known for his podcast in the realm of Doctor Who. Not only is he the co-host of Radio Free Skaro, probably the oldest and most popular Who podcast around, but he was also one of the architects of the long-running and rather hilarious The Memory Cheats, and now co-hosts the eponymously effortless Lazy Doctor Who here on the Incomparable Network. And if none of that rings a bell, he's the guy who spent 2 years building that Lego baseball park on his dining table. Oh, that guy. Indeed. So, welcome to the show, Stephen Schepansky.
Thank you very much, Anthony.
Now, I'm really looking forward to this one because, frankly, you and I are like the only people that I now that I know as adults who actually have watched this show. So,
I know.
Tell us what you've chosen and then give us some context around its release, the time of its release, its reception upon release, why it is... Well, in this case, we're talking about something that's overlooked rather than maligned. And then tell us why you think, you know, that's a bad thing and more people should be aware of it.
Well, it might be overlooked because it's maligned. But what you've gathered me onto this podcast today, and I'm thrilled to say this, is we're going to be talking about the 1987 BBC series Star Cops, which aired for 9 episodes in the summer of 1987. Back in the day when summer series were not really the hottest thing and it was scheduled against stronger programming, and it died a quick death, sadly. And honestly, I don't know how it became such a phenomenon, perhaps just because it had a sci-fi bent to it. But I first saw it, I think, in 1990 or 1991 when my local PBS station here in Canada, we picked up the PBS station from Spokane, Washington. They aired the series on weeknights. I managed to just sort of catch it in the TV guide. And I said, "Ooh, Star Cops, that sounds science fiction. I'll watch." And I just loved it. I just loved all 9 episodes and was kind of amazed that nothing else really became of it and no one else really enjoyed the show as much as I did over the course of the several years afterwards.
Well, at least you knew other people who'd seen it then, because... I was going to ask how you saw it, because this was broadcast, yeah, it was really badly scheduled. BBC Two, which has always been sort of the minority channel of the BBC. 1987, I mean, I did see this when it was first broadcast, but it was never repeated. As to the best of my knowledge, it has never been repeated on the BBC. And so I had only vague memories of it, to be honest. I remembered it being kind of serious, kind of cheap, you know, in the same sense as someone like Doctor Who. And it just didn't stick in my mind. I was 15 when it was being broadcast. So, and it was a year before things like Red Dwarf, which of course enveloped sort of sci-fi pop culture, especially on the BBC, so much because so quickly because it was so popular. And at the time, I was much more interested in adventure sci-fi, frankly, you know, Star Wars and stuff, or even Hitchhikers, you know, comedy like Hitchhikers and Red Dwarf. So I remembered that I'd watched it, but I could barely remember anything about it. And then I came upon the DVD set, and I decided to, well, I say I came upon it. I decided to look for it because I had this memory of the show, and then rewatched it on the DVDs because I was prepping to launch a new comic series called The Fuse, which is a cops in space story, which wasn't at the time exactly an overused genre. Ironically, now there's dozens of the flipping things, but at the time there were not many around. And I thought, I should watch that to make sure I'm not unconsciously ripping anything off. I mean, as it happens, I needn't have worried. They are, you know, very, very far apart. But yeah, upon rewatching it, I was like, I think I can see why it was never rebroadcast and why it hasn't been repeated and why most people just don't remember it. But at the same time, I think that's a real shame because there are some really good elements of this show. It's kind of a shame that it wasn't made 10 years later when, you know, special effects and the budget and the sets would all have been so much better.
Yeah, it would have been on film probably, or something, or at least maybe even widescreen at that point. I had the prescience to actually, you know, because this is back in my teenage years when I was videotaping everything and saving it. And so I didn't just watch Dark Ops. I somehow knew that I was going to want to, you know, to tape this, because I think they said it's 9 episodes, which when you chop out all, you know, all the pledge breaks and stuff, and it's like a 50-minute episode, I can get 9 of those on one VHS tape. This is perfect, you know, an 8-hour VHS tape. So I didn't just watch it when I was like 15 or whatever year it was. I had it throughout my entire life. You know, I would just sometimes dip back and watch Dark Ops. So it's always sort of been there. So all the little, you know, the elements of it that perhaps are less successful when you look at them years later after having not watched it are just kind of washed to me. Like the theme song. I love the theme song unabashedly.
Oh, you're kidding.
I love the theme song. And it gets stuck in my head. You know, I tell you though, if it wasn't for the fact that it's just always been there, I think I would not like it now. But I just, yeah, I wow. like it. Perhaps because it's no one else likes it, and it's a fun thing to be able to say that you might want to have in your CD collection.
Like the ripple on the water sends a message to the shore, so I know forever after I will miss you.
That was something that I had completely forgotten before I came to rewatch it. And then as I was rewatching it and started, I was like, oh God, I'd forgotten how bad this was. I mean, you know that that's Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues.
Yes, I do.
So you'd kind of expect it to be in tune, perhaps. You know, that would be a start, as well as a better song, because it's terrible. And it is literally out of tune in places.
I know.
It's unbelievable. And this was broadcasting. Oh, dear. I mean, right, for listeners who aren't familiar, think back to how surprised and then disappointed that you were when you first heard the theme tune to Enterprise. And then realize that this is worse.
I would argue that Enterprise is worse.
I love this show, but it is a terrible theme tune.
It is sad that a lot of people, like whenever I make a joke that I like Star Cops or something like that, you know, I was talking to Nicholas Briggs, for instance, of Big Finish fame, and he was, you know, I jokingly suggested in an interview that perhaps they should look at doing Star Cops audio dramas and stuff. And then, of course, his response to me, well, it won't be easy.
It won't be easy.
And, you know, that was a joke, obviously, because that's...
Wow, that is some deep nerdery right there.
That is indeed. It's funny, is at the same convention that Matt Irvine was there. The next day, he did visual effects for a lot of BBC shows in the 70s and 80s, and he's doing a little presentation in the room, and he's showing various slides of stuff he's worked on, and he goes, okay, I bet you no one in this room knows what this is, and boom, he pops up, and it's a little moon rover from one of the episodes of Star Cops, and the whole room is silent, so I look at my chance, okay, Star Cops! So, like, the whole theme of the weekend was Star Cops. I almost felt like I've created this little mini wave of Star Cops enthusiasm thanks to one weekend at Chicago TARDIS.
Oh, man, if the Big Finish guys are listening to this, you should totally do that, and you should totally ask somebody like me to write them.
There you go. It'd be perfect.
David Calder's still around. Unfortunately, a number of the other members of the cast have passed away, but David Calder's still around.
He is, yeah. I think it's David Calder, I think, who is still my favorite thing about the show.
I think his
performance is just that anchor that the show needs. You know, he's just kind of like a, I don't know what to, you know, I just liked him. I just remember really liking him at the time.
He's just he plays it really well. He does something that I love in sci-fi, and I often do myself, which is that he's so in the world that he is completely blasé about the sci-fi elements.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing kind of special or wow about the fact that they're going into orbit, you know, or he's on a moon rover or anything like that. It's just part of the job and part of the world that the character lives in.
Sorry, I should have warned you that was going to happen.
You did.
So do all the training people. You leave Earth and anything you forget to bring with you will kill you. Anything you do bring with you which doesn't work properly will kill you. When in doubt, assume everything's going to kill you.
Thought you didn't believe all that stuff.
I don't. That's the trouble with training. Even when you don't believe it, you believe it.
Moon Rover 7, please prepare for voice identification as a preliminary to security clearance for access to Outpost 9.
Yes, this is Moon Rover 7, ready for voice identification.
Please speak now.
You know, it used to take a lot of talent and the right sort of upbringing to be polite and have filthy manners at the same time. Now it just takes a computer.
Commander Nathan Spring, Senior Officer, International Space Police Force, is identified. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a man's got to do what a man's got to do.
Inspector David Theroux of the International Space Police Force is identified. Thank you.
Man's got to do.
Yeah, you know
please
who said that.
Transmit your journey
just about every
authorization.
Drunk thought he was funny, I should imagine.
No, no, come on. Anybody who claims to know movies ought to know who said a man's got to do what a man's got to do.
All right, let me think. It's a film. And it's a quote.
Moon Rover 7, you
runs.
Will proceed
no.
to Outpost 9.
You know what he did.
A man's got to do what a man's got to do. Now, let me just run it through.
And that's sometimes tough to pull off, but Calder pulls that off so well, and it really anchors the character and helps the viewer anchor themselves in the series, I think. So give us, we haven't actually said what this series is about, so give the listeners a quick premise. Because, yeah, okay, 9 episodes didn't last very long, but give them a bit of premise about what the show's actually about.
Well, the show is made in 1987, but set in the far-off space year of 2027. So, what, 40 years after the fact that it was sort of set. And so, therefore, it's a sci-fi show, but it's not really. It's kind of like, you know, there's a moon base. There's a few floating space stations in space. There's a Mars colony, a very new one, more or less. So it's sort of set in this sort of realistic future world that we could sort of envision happening, you know, in 1987. And, you know, as it's said in the show at some point, where there's spacemen, there's policemen. And so there's a small little group of police officers, affectionately termed as star cops, that help solve crimes. And so it's basically kind of like just a whodunit in space. I don't think the science fiction elements ever take over in the plots of these episodes, but they just sort of form the backbone of real normal human dramas, I think. And I think that was the success of the show.
Absolutely, yeah. One of the things that I've always thought about the show, and one of the reasons that I've sometimes thought, wouldn't it be nice if they kind of remade this, was that the storylines would barely need to be changed. You know, most of them would still make sense now, even though our knowledge of the future, if I can put it like that, is very different now to what it was in 1987. You know, we're all so much more aware of what technology can do, what technology will probably be like in the future. But as you say, the science fiction aspects never take over. They inform the mysteries and the crimes. But, you know, stuff like using space for drug smuggling, the cover-up of dead scientists to protect corporate profits. You've got a military complex denying that their Black Ops project actually exists and stonewalling the cops. These are universal themes, especially in a detective story. And you even see similar stuff in a show like Foyle's War, which is set during World War II. You know, they're essentially the same. You're just changing the setting and the location. It's the old people are still people and crime is still crime. So it really wouldn't take much to update it. And I think that's a strength of the series. That's another thing that's it's got in its favor.
Yeah, and it goes back to what you're saying about David Calder and how he just, you know, he treats everything around him as just sort of normal. Like he, in this series, he has a prototype that his late father used to be a computer salesman or something and managed to, like, procure. I think that was the story of Box. He has this little iPhone-shaped magic box that sort of talks to him.
More like a Newton, let's be honest.
yeah, more like a Newton. But, I mean, you know, and it taps into computers and everything else. It's very much a prototype of a smartphone that everyone, you know, a couple of people sort of marvel about, and you sort of go, oh, it's just a prototype, don't worry about it, you know, that sort of thing. It's his special little tool that sort of keeps him ahead of the game a little bit. But, I mean, that sort of, you know, that's 1986 they made that thing in, and there were, you know, predicting almost, you know, the internet isn't quite mentioned, but you can get the idea that it perhaps is a thing. You know, there's a lot of forward thinking stuff on this show. And I think, like you said, it's if they all reacted to it like, oh, this is a new thing called these computers can speak to each other and everything that, then I think everyone, they would be so dated. But the fact that everyone just lives in this world and gets on, you know, every house, because the first couple of episodes are partially set on Earth. And every house has like this big giant view screen in where they're just sort of like talking back and forth on Skype, more or less, you know, and it just seems to be normal behavior for them. And it's neat to sort of like, it was fun watching it in the 90s and 2000s. And then I haven't really watched it in a few years. And so now that, you know, smartphones are a thing and Skype is a thing, it looks even that more prescient when I watch it now.
Totally, yeah. Especially as they all say "screen off" at the end at the end of calls. You're like, no, just press a button. You're all right.
Yeah.
I mean, Nathan Spring, he's a superintendent, I believe, originally, and then becomes a commander of the Space Cops, played by David Calder. He's a really interesting character. He arrested his father for fraud, I think.
Yeah.
Or something. Who, as you say, was a computer salesman and, you know, has his prototype, which, incidentally, the actor also voices. It has his own voice.
I know. And it's
processed slightly.
It is. I know. Some episodes are more processed than others, and sometimes I don't quite get that it's him actually speaking it, which is, you know, further, because he's actually, reacting to something that he's obviously, you know, probably some tape delayed, you know, something he's reacting to himself on tape, and it's so natural yet again.
Do I use people, Box?
How long an answer do you want?
Brief.
Well, be more specific.
Do I exploit people unfairly?
Is it possible to exploit people fairly?
Box, I am doing this for psychotherapy. I don't want a lesson in semantics.
You have said before that you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs.
Or cookery.
It is part of your job to make people act against their natures. The technique you use is a matter for your own conscience to decide.
I don't know. It just seems that since Lee died, I've become less sensitive, more mechanical. What do you think?
I don't see being mechanical as anything to be ashamed of.
Thank you, Box. That's all.
Why isn't David Calder in more stuff? I watch this show, and every time I go, why hasn't David Calder been like one of those great actors of the age? Because I haven't seen him in as much as I should have, quite frankly.
He's a British character actor, mostly. He hasn't, had a lot of lead roles. I mean, you see him a lot. He is in a lot of British drama, but as in character roles, not in lead or regularly recurring roles. And I don't know why either, because I think he's a really good actor. Has continued to be, even in his character roles. When he turns up in, A Midsummer Murders or something, you know that it's going to be a good one, because you're going to get a good performance out of him. When he has the conversations with Box, and it's his own voice. But that's also a nice irony, because one of the things they make clear very early on about the character, about Nathan Spring, is that it's not that he doesn't trust technology, but that he thinks cops have gotten lazy because cops just let computers do everything for them. And he's, in the grand tradition, he's an old fashioned kind of copper who wants to use his brain and a bit of shoe leather to solve a mystery. And so on the one hand, he uses computers as little as possible, but on the other, he's got, as you say, an artificial intelligence you know, something as advanced or more advanced even than an iPhone that he uses constantly to help him figure stuff out. So
it's a sonic screwdriver in some ways, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, like a magic box. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why people have spoken unkindly about Eric Ray Evans, who played David Threw, his second in command.
There's a two-man freighter gone rogue, heading to the dark. Flight crew's dead.
Well, how did that happen?
Investigations are proceeding. Isn't that standard cop speak for a we're unlikely ever to know?
Well, what investigations? Who's doing these investigations?
The flight crew, naturally.
You just said they were dead.
Yeah, technically speaking, but not, you know.
Inspector Threw, it may have escaped your notice, but I am feeling a little below par. Now, that tends to make me irritable. You add somebody playing silly bastards and I become homicidal.
They've got limited life support and no fuel left to correct their course. They'll run out of air before they run out of space. That's standard crew speak for they're dead, and everyone including them knows it.
Oh, I see.
Do you?
I have things to learn.
Yeah.
Because I quite enjoyed his performance. He's one of those that has sadly left us now. He died back in 1999. But it's that supporting staff that I actually quite like as well. And their not only their interactions with Nathan Spring, as played by David Calder. I'm not sure we've ever even said his name yet. But also him and Davis and Pal Kenzie and, you know, the whole international cast. I think it's a really good mix of characters, I think.
It is, I agree. Eric Ray Evans' performance, I'm sort of on the side of, you know, that's one of the elements that occasionally makes me cringe when I'm watching it now from a modern perspective. But I think you've got to remember, and he's not the only person guilty of this whatsoever. There is quite a bit of overacting going on, but you've got to remember the context of the times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe it was down to the actors and directors thinking like, oh, it's sci-fi, so everybody's, you know, it's all got to be big. Everybody's got to shout and everything's got to be really intense. Or most of these actors at the time were primarily theatre actors. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether some of them were having trouble translating their performances onto screen. I mean, who knows? It's impossible to say, but it is, I think it's something that you definitely have to get past to be able to watch and enjoy the show. There is a lot more melodrama in the acting than we would now expect from, you know, a fairly naturalistic drama like this.
Yeah, the one thing that doesn't look as good is the treatments of other countries and cultures. I think the most broadest stereotypes imaginable for some of them, like the American station. When they go to the American station, it's that one character is trying to get a hold of the commander in chief of Ronald Reagan. That's the name of the station, the U.S. station, of course. And there's this this huge fanfare from 2001 that greets the person as she comes online, and it's Daniel Benzali plays the commander. He's a cigar chomping Dallas Cowboys t-shirt wearing pool playing hustler of a commander. It just like it was so broadly drawn that even back then I go, oh, this is a little too far, I think.
Very popular with our people. You shouldn't underestimate the importance of that.
Oh, I don't, especially as I'm not. Popular with your people, I mean. Top left. Since I sacked Inspector Hubble, your State Department can't make its mind up whether I'm the Antichrist or just anti-American.
Same thing.
Yes. Center pocket.
Hubble was an American national, working for an American company.
No, he was a star cop working for me. Top left.
You had no right to fire him without consultation.
Oh, we didn't fire him. And we did consult him. He resigned.
Like Richard Nixon?
Yes, that's right. Top right.
He may have been a son of a bitch, but he was our son of a bitch.
In my country, right or wrong, eh?
There are worse philosophies.
Yes, most of them begin with that. Center pocket.
You and Thoreau should be getting on real well.
Now, why do you say that?
Your second in command's a little short on patriotism.
I knew there was something about that fellow that I liked.
Did you know he was a student radical?
Weren't we all?
No.
Oh. Well, if you're not radical as a kid, where's there to go in your reactionary old age?
Not on our space program, that's for damn sure.
Or lost, maybe.
I don't think so.
Well, he's turning out to be a good copper.
Oh, yeah, I preferred Hubble.
Hubble wasn't even a good crook.
They are constantly playing Paul over on the American station, aren't they? I forgot. Does he literally wear a Dallas Cowboys shirt? I hadn't realized that.
He literally has a Dallas Cowboys shirt on.
Oh, wow. Wow. But yeah, you're right that the national stereotyping, and frankly, not just national, but the racial stereotyping in some cases is that's. But again, you've got to remember this was the mid to late 80s. This series was made when the Berlin Wall was still standing. Mm-hmm. Germany was still two countries. Li Jianan was still premier of China, for heaven's sake. These were not globally enlightened times. So, I mean, yes, even so, even in 1987, they could have done better. But I think you have to take it in context. And this ties back to something you said a moment ago, in the main characters, they often broke those stereotypes. They used the stereotypes for the sake of the secondary characters, for the plots and the stories. Like, yes, the Americans were, as you say, cigar-chomping, you know, gung-ho imperialists, and the Chinese were all inscrutable, and the Italians were all mafia members and what have you. But in the main cast, they were very diverse racially. They were diverse in terms of nationality. Not so much in gender. There's only one woman, but even one woman on a cop show, frankly, in the 80s was, you know, still relatively unusual.
Well, there was two. Anna Shun joined later on, the script editor's behest, who didn't even know about her being added, another reason why the show never died. Chris Boucher, who made the show, did not get along with Evgeny Gridnev, who was the producer, and I think Gridnev added Anna Shun into the episodes later in the run.
Oh, wow.
And Boucher didn't even know about it. So that was another reason why they didn't get along and why the show, I think, probably didn't succeed as well.
You mentioned Boucher, and he's a name that I kind of know, but I'm guessing that you probably know more about him than me, because his previous work included stuff like Doctor Who and Blake 7. Now, were you aware of those connections when you watched this series, or is that just this strange coincidence that's come to light, you know, over the years?
At the time I didn't. Now that when I watch the episodes, especially the ones written by him, it is so evident, because Boucher has this way with really good, quick-witted, bantery dialogue. He's done it in his Doctor Who episodes, mostly in Robots of Death. A lot of the interplay between the characters of Blake 7 that we've all come to know and love over the years is mainly down to his influence. And so when I see them bantering back and forth, especially in the opening two episodes, there's a lot of Boucher-esque, if I can coin that phrase, banter back and forth. And I think I honestly think he's one of England's great underrated writers. I think he's been responsible for so much greatness in TV that we haven't really paid him as much tribute as I think we could have. So when I, you know, now that I look back at it, I sort of put Star Cops in that high echelon of well-written shows that Boucher has done over the years.
Certainly thinking about Blake 7, I'm not the sort of the great Blake 7 fan that many people, including yourself, I know are, but I did very much enjoy it when I watched it as a kid. And one of the things that always stuck with me was that it felt like the first sci-fi show where people actually argued with one another and where you had distinctly different personalities who, yes, they were all aiming for the same goal, but that didn't mean that they had to necessarily like one another. And that was done really well in Blake 7. And you do get that quite a bit in Star Cops as well, which again, I think is quite, you know, and it's an element of realism in the show, is that most of the characters don't actually get along or like one another, but they're thrown into it because this is their job.
Yeah, and it leads to those little moments when they do sort of, you know, see eye to eye, even just for a little bit, you know, like Davis and Anna Shun in that one episode. And, you know, it's kind of heartwarming. It's like, oh, they're getting along now. When, you know, just a few episodes ago, I remember Davis and David Throw were having a huge argument that Spring walks in on, and it's, you know, it's how are these two going to react when they're alone in the same room together later on? And they sort of have a begrudging respect for each other a little bit. And yeah, you're right. I think that comes straight from that Blake 7 kind of you know, opening scene of Robots of Death when they're all wearing those huge hats and, you know, resting about in the lounge and just sort of bantering, bickering back and forth, but all sort of interested in money, you know. It's that theme that's going on through all of Boucher's work over the years.
Yeah, and as a result, as you say, it's a bit of a shame that he hasn't done more, really.
Yeah, the another thing that that really I think what really got me interested in this series, I think probably starting in episode 4, was I noticed at the end there. Actually, I could tell watching the episode that this looks like it's directed by, yep, it sure is. It's directed by Graham Harper, who directed 4 of the episodes, I think, but directed the middle 3. After the first 3 were directed by a guy called Christopher Baker. Graham Harper is, without a doubt, my favorite director in the history of British television. He did The Caves of Androzani and Revelation of the Daleks in the classic series, and has gone on, I think, to direct 11, I think, of the new series episodes. And I've always been a huge fan of his work. And you watch the first 3 episodes, and everything is like really brightly lit. And they're almost, to be honest, a little harder to follow. In watching the whole series again in preparation for this, I was expecting to like the first 3 episodes, as I usually do, especially episode 2. And then after that, I thought maybe it just gets, you know, get a little bit less brilliant as the episodes go along. But this time around, I found myself having a hard time following the dialogue, because it's sort of all happening at once. Because Christopher Baker is basically catching all the action on one, like, long range, like just a wide angle. Everyone's like sort of, and that might be just because in the first couple episodes they're floating around in a moon base, and it might be tough to sort of get different camera angles just in case you see the wires or something that they're hanging on. And so it just, there's not quite as much dramatic tension in those episodes. But then you get Harper behind the camera, and there's a lot of close-ups, just, you know, really tight close-ups of conversations, and everyone's on, you know, they're just quick cuts in between, and there's a lot of, like, some of the scenes are just lit by, like, computer screens, you know, when Nathan Spring's, like, sneaking around a place, and he's got Box looking at the computer systems, and it's the only light in that whole scene is coming out of the computer monitor, which, you know, for a 1980s BBC videotape TV series is just remarkable, you know? And so I think, on watching this, I think I liked the middle 3 episodes a lot more this time around, just because I was really struck for some reason this time around about the direction. And then later on, Christopher Baker comes back and does a couple more, and everything's bright again. And then Harper comes back for the last episode, and it's back down to dark, and it's this weird give and take for the two series directors.
So it was just 2 directors on the whole series?
Yes, it was. I think, yeah, they're originally going to make 10 episodes, but the last one had to be canceled because of a strike at the BBC, which happened a lot in those days.
Ah, yes.
And Harper was going to direct that one. So it would have been 5 and 5, basically.
Right. Yeah, I mean, now that you mention that, I wasn't aware of that at all, but you're right. Those 3 sort of middle episodes, as it were, are, I mean, they are very well directed, but they're also, story-wise, they're really good as well. Mm-hmm. And I wonder maybe if my opinion of the story is actually coloured by the way that they're directed. Because certainly, you know, I know that can have an effect. You can take the same story, give it to 2 directors, and even on TV, where obviously the, you know, production schedule is much faster and has less luxury for reshoots and, frankly, creativity. But even so, you can give it to 2 different directors and you'll get a very different show out of it, as you just mentioned. So yeah, that's interesting, because those are my favorite episodes, those, that chunk in the middle where you have like the Americans and the nuclear waste rocket, and then the dead scientists, the frozen scientists, mm-hmm. In the shuttle craft. Those are really good episodes, all of them. And those are all ones, like I mentioned earlier, where the plot is based around the science, but as you said earlier, it doesn't overtake the case and the investigation, but they are all crimes that are sort of, the details of them are very specific to the science fiction setting.
Mm-hmm. And it takes, you know, it takes some scientific knowledge and sort of getting to the bottom of it, but it also just takes good old-fashioned copying, you know. Copying, coined another phrase, I guess. I think Harper's direction really focused on the claustrophobic nature of living on the moon base. You know, I think maybe the first episodes were set on the space station. It sort of has this sort of, you know, probably inaccurate, actually, this sort of inaccurate view of it being just this wide open space, and, you know, the control room is huge and everything. And then, but really, space stations aren't like that from what we see on NASA films. They're just basically tightly little contained tin cans floating in space. But the moon base is just seems to be that much more claustrophobic. I mean, there's a couple different offices, but there's, you know, there's corridors mostly. The whole thing is all corridors. It's just like Doctor Who in a way. And I think Harper really, really captured that, that claustrophobic feel better than the other guy.
Can we just like take a moment to, you know, celebrate the inclusion of Pal Kenzie? Because, like I say, in the mid to late 80s, certainly on the BBC, female cops in any series were still pretty unusual, you know, pretty rare. And to have one in a, you know, a fairly major recurring role, and she's not even English, you know, she's Australian as well. That was unusual. It was quite forward thinking. I was really glad to see that when I sort of rewatched this and thought about, well, hang on a second, 1987, good Lord, you know, like all those years ago. It really was, and she's quite a complex character as well, which is the other thing. They do make a little sort of, you know, she has unfortunate, like, silly woman tendencies occasionally. But most of the time, she's tough. She comes from a background as a corrupt copper and is now trying to prove herself to be better, which is a very interesting character trait. So, yeah, she's one that, you know, I think... again, as part of this series, doesn't get the due that the series and that she should for being quite groundbreaking in some respects.
Yes, Kenzie?
I wanted to warn you that I intend to resign, sir.
Fine, get a hard copy, sign it, put it on my workstation, screen off.
Reconnect. You didn't give me time to finish, Commander. What I was going to say is that I intend to resign unless you give me something more interesting to do.
Fine, get a hard copy, sign it, put it on my workstation.
So you do still intend to get rid of me?
I just don't want you to have any illusions about your future in the Star Cops.
I made a lot of good publicity out of what could have been a lot of bad publicity. That doesn't count for anything.
That's right, that doesn't count for anything. Public relations is not your job.
Well, what exactly is my job? Sitting here taking messages.
Yes.
You know this is constructive dismissal, don't you? I think the press might find your attitude very interesting.
Well, I think the press are about as reliable as you are.
Look, I'm not resigning, sir.
I'm just about as consistent. Well, is that it, Kenzie, or did you just call me up to play musical resignations?
Your ETA on Ronald Reagan.
2350.
You knew that already.
I was just checking, sir.
Yeah, it's and her performance, I think, you know, she's sort of out to, like, you know, out for number one in the early bits. You know, when she stops a terrorist attack, she's not like, yay, we stopped a terrorist attack. No, her first words are like, you know, when the press gets hold of this, we're going to be heroes, you know, that sort of thing. It's but she changes from that into a, you know, a moderately caring person towards the end, which, you know, she brings back Anishuna hat. Which I always thought was the sweetest thing. She goes to the French base, Charles de Gaulle station. She brings her back a present. And there's actually a couple of sweet moments in the last episode too, between her and Nathan Spring. You know, I don't know if they would have, if it would have gone on, would it have been a budding romance or something like that? But there's sort of an affection between the two characters. And that's something that I just was not expecting to see when we first see Pal Kenzie come on board.
No, absolutely, because she is this tough-as-nails character who just bristles at the slightest kind of supposition that she might have a softer side. And as you say, she's a glory hound. She is, I mean, he fires her. The very first time we meet her, he fires her for corruption. It's, you know, and then, yes, because of the terrorist thing, yeah, he's pretty much forced to take her back on. And, but then by the end of it, it does feel almost natural because of the evolution of her character. It feels almost natural that her and Nathan would start to get along a little bit better. So yeah, it's, I mean, she's just one character in the team, but as I say, considering how rare competent female cops were in any series in 1987. I think it's worth, yeah, just taking a moment to celebrate this particular character.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Devis then? not speaking of competent cops.
Yeah, Devis was, for listeners who haven't seen it, Colin Devis was a... He was an old colleague of Springs back on Earth, wasn't he?
No, he was. It was him, Devis, who, as we spoil the hell out of this, it was assigned to a case involving Nathan Spring in episode two. I didn't think they'd actually met at that point, but it's odd because I don't think Nathan Spring was that, you know, that. Didn't think much of Devis during the course of that case, and so for the fact that he actually hires him on as a star cop later on seems a little bit odd, but funny at the same time.
Yeah, and he never actually seems to solve anything. He has like maybe one or two moments of insight.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they were going for with his character was the idea that, like, well, you need a bulldog.
Yeah,
you need somebody who may not be the most refined character or the sharpest knife in the box, frankly, but he's a bulldog and he will not let go of a case or an interrogation or, you know, a suspect or whatever. But you can see that they were going for that, but they really just didn't quite get there. Instead, he just comes across as sexist, obnoxious, and a bit thick at times.
How come I get all the good jobs? That's what I want to know.
You found out anything yet?
Have we hell? Do you know what we're looking for? Three bloody embryos. Three little tadpoles.
Yeah, well, it's the honour of the force that's at stake, Colin. I mean, it doesn't look very good having a kidnap on your own doorstep.
No, it's not a kidnap. She probably flushed the things down the bloody loo. What I don't understand is what a silly bitch had to have it done on the moon.
Of course, the chances of conception are doubled at low gravity.
It amazes me, the things you know.
Well, considering your one-track mind, it amazes me the things you don't know.
Yeah, he's a bit of a lout, which is a shame. But I enjoy his loutishness a little more than I think I thought it would. I think it helps that Trevor Cooper, who plays him, does a great little performance. He's another favorite of Graham Harper's, actually. He was in one of his Doctor Who stories, Revelation of the Daleks, and that's where I remembered him from. And so when I saw Trevor Cooper's name pop up on the cast list of Doctor Who in Robot of Sherwood, actually, he played Friar Tuck in that. I was like, oh, good.
Yes.
A star cop is going to be in Doctor Who.
Wow, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, I was so pleased by that.
Yeah, he's another one who does pop up all over the place on British TV as a bit part and character actor. And, you know, on the bright side, at least he was another white Englishman. At least they didn't give that type of personality to the black guy or the woman or the Russian or the Chinese, you know. So I can I find it a little less egregious because at least we already have another English white guy who is actually hyper competent in the form of Nathan Spring to sort of set that off.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that I was never quite understanding what the role of Kravenko was. Jonathan Adams plays him. He was sort of like the commander of the base, but we don't meet him until like four or five episodes in. Was he always there as a commander? Like, what is the commander of the moon base actually do? I've often sort of been confused by his role.
I'm afraid I have another case for you.
Look, it never rains, but it pours.
Pardon?
It's an English expression.
Now, I received news this morning that a radio contact has been lost with a very dear colleague of mine, Christina Jensen.
The cell regeneration expert?
Oh, you've heard of her. Well, you know then that she works in an orbiting lab. Her regulation call-ins have not been received for 60 hours.
But what do you need is a radio mechanic.
No, I need a friend with security clearance and transport. Her course will bring her opposite the moon in 3 hours' time.
You're not asking me to go there now, are you? Alex, look, I have been waiting for 48 hours for the go-ahead on Pluto 5.
You have deputies.
I could say the same to you.
This woman is my dearest, most honored colleague. I have brave fears for her safety. I cannot order you to go there. I can only tell you how important it is to me.
Yeah, he is very much one of those middle managers. We're like, what do you actually do all day?
Exactly. You know, doesn't wear an outfit, sort of has a suit on sometimes, or not a space suit, but a business suit that you would wear in space, perhaps, we'll call it. Yeah, it's odd. He has a weird relationship with different people, and at one point he's like wearing an actual suit at a press conference when he's back on Earth, and I'm not too sure what was going on there, but he has a couple nice little scenes, I guess. He's very stoic in his Russianness, which I suppose at the time was kind of a thing because, you know, 1987, this was, for those of you who don't remember, the Cold War was in its waning days, but it was still kind of a thing for people of our generation. And so to have a Russian as the head of the actual moon base, I think was quite forward-thinking.
Oh, well, and he's a good example, I think, of one of the characters that breaks the stereotypes because, yes, he's a kind of stoic Russian, but he bends the rules. He's quite compassionate in some instances. He's, mm-hmm. you know, he never comes across as the obnoxious communist that he could have quite easily been portrayed as you say, the era of, you know, Gorbachev, I think, had been premier for less than 2 years when this was broadcast. So when it was being made, he'd probably only just been appointed.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we were still in the era of post like Brezhnev and Andropov and real hardline, hardcore communist leaders in the Soviet Union. So yeah, having a Russian in command of the base, in command of a multinational base, and also being not a horrible man was actually kind of, like I say, was breaking those stereotypes. It's, you know, yeah, it's small baby steps, but for the time, again, in context, I was quite forward thinking.
It was probably more so than Anna Shone, the doctor on the team, who was just very much your, you know, your stereotypical meek Japanese woman, who sort of, I think she opened up a little bit as the episodes went along.
We have to find a man called Albie. Kenzie left us some leaves.
Why did she have to go?
Nathan has to negotiate with Mrs. Asadi. Perhaps he felt a woman's touch might be required.
Yeah, I bet he did. Dirty dog, where's the room?
Thank you. Davy's returning this afternoon. His left hand is injured.
Oh, is it? Well, I expect he'll be needing a woman's touch as well then, Anna.
No. He will require a doctor.
You know, if your understanding of English were better, you'd recognise a joke when you heard one.
If you were more sophisticated, I might share your sense of humour.
I didn't mind her either. I thought, I think the scenes between her and Davis in that one episode, A Double Life, it was called, I think are actually really good. Where she has to make a choice. I'm not sure how much we're spoiling of this in case people want to go. The great thing about this show is that, you know, it's not on Netflix or anything like that, but a lot of people have uploaded the entire episodes to YouTube.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I've downloaded them and burned them on a DVD years ago. I didn't pull it out once. They're all on YouTube for those who want to seek them out, all 9 episodes. And even a DVD extra, which has some studio footage of a day of shooting on StarCop. So if you want to see 40 minutes of cameras lining up for their next shot, you could even watch that. So there's yeah, a wealth of... Yeah.
They're not the most tantalizing extras, it must be said. But then, you know, back then... I mean, you know, let's not forget, this is only, what, you know, 15, 20 years after the BBC used to regularly delete videotapes of shows if they needed space in the archives, as you well know from, you know, from Doctor Who. So the idea that they might also keep footage of behind-the-scenes stuff, they didn't do that as a matter of course. So it's no surprise that the DVD extras are a little... thin.
Yeah, they just forgot to wipe it. We missed that one. I guess we should have deleted that. But and there's also a great there was a series, I don't remember when it was a 6-part series called The Cult of ... and they looked at 6 cult series over the years. It was on BBC4, I think, I want to say.
Okay.
That had they looked at Blake 7, Adam Adamant, I think Survivors might have been in there as well. Tripods, on that, and another series that I can't remember, and then Star Cops, and so and they actually have interviews with David Calder and Trevor Cooper and Boucher and Gridneff at the time, like, you know, when 2004 or 2005 or something like that, as well as a couple of other journalists in there to sort of give their thoughts and opinions. And that's also full episodes of those are on YouTube as well, if you want to sort of get an entry-level guide into the series.
Oh, that's one I will have to find and then put a link to in the show notes myself, because I'd like to see that myself.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I've talked about StarCop so much to people over the years who have never even seen it. And just sort of now laugh along with me. And then I realize that I'm the only one that's actually watched this show. People should watch this. It's a good show that I think demands and commands another listen, another watch rather, because I think it has been much maligned. Misquote the name of your podcast. Well,
and just to reassure listeners, actually, in terms of spoilers, we haven't actually spoiled a lot, because remember, this is essentially a crime series. So yes, we've talked about, you know, sort of character developments and stuff like that, but it's not like we're giving away the actual, you know, like the identities of the murderer or the criminal and stuff like that. So these, you know, you can still watch them and enjoy them and play along, if you like, with the crimes and the mysteries. We haven't spoiled that aspect of it. And talking about Anna Shoon, just going quickly back to that, at least Anna Shoon was actually played by a Japanese actress.
That's true.
Because,
yeah.
We here, and I know this is an issue in the States as well, but especially over here, we have a long and embarrassing history of casting Chinese, Korean, you know, Singaporean, good Lord knows what people as Japanese, and vice versa, and Japanese people as Chinese characters, and it's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
It is. So, yeah.
So thank goodness that she was actually at least a Japanese woman playing a Japanese character.
I think Bert Kwok has played people from all sorts of different countries all over the Eastern Asia over the course of his career. So, yeah.
I think that's the main thing to take away from this, is that so many people have never even heard of Star Cops, and a lot of people who have heard of it just think, oh yeah, that was that really bad series from the BBC that only ran for a few episodes. And it's not. It is from the BBC and only ran for a few episodes, but it is good. It is good. Yes, you have to take it in context of the times. You know, it's like watching pre-reboot Doctor Who. You have to get past the wobbly sets and the bad lighting and, you know, the sort of theatrical style of acting. That's just how we were over here, okay? Live with it. If you, if you can get past that, this is a series with good stories, good characters, good, fairly hard sci-fi as well. At no point do people bring out laser guns. At no point is there any, you know, aliens with pasties on their foreheads. There's no time travel. There's nothing at all that you associate with space opera or space fantasy. This is good, relatively hard, near future sci-fi with great characters, good stories. And, you know, if that's your kind of thing, you really should seek this out.
I could say it better myself. I want to watch it again now after hearing that, what you just said about it. No. I've filled my head with StarCops over the past few days, and I want to see it all again. You know, and there's some great, I mean, the other two writers who wrote for this series were John Colley, who's gone on to write several Hollywood films. Master and Commander, Far Side of the World, was written by him.
Oh, wow.
Which stunned me at the time. And Philip Martin, who's written a couple Doctor Who episodes, but he also made Gangsters, another much overlooked series from the 1970s in the UK. So there's some real talent going on in front of and behind the cameras on this thing. It's an overlooked gem.
Absolutely. All right. Stephen Chbosky, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
If you like what I have to say, you can follow me at Legopolis, Legopolis, the Lego City, so to speak. And I'm also on part of the Radio Free Scarrow, the Memory Cheats, and Lazy Doctor Who, all one word, Twitter accounts as well. You can find me on there. Sometimes I tweet back to you. Who knows?
I'm so glad that you mentioned that Legopolis is a metropolis of Lego. See, I wasn't sure if it was that, or if it was some kind of play on Lego Police.
No, there's a Doctor Who story called Legopolis, and Legopolis is like...
Oh, is there?
Yeah, so I decided that I would put both of them together to mimic my enjoyment of both Doctor Who and Lego as my Twitter handle all those years ago. So
Now I feel like a fool for just not guessing that.
Oh, no,
I should have known.
Right.
I should have known.
It's subtle, you see? It's subtle.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. For example, if Sci-Fi Cops Investigating Crimes in Space pushes your buttons, you may enjoy my graphic novel series, The Fuse, in which two homicide cops solve murders in a crowded orbiting city. The Fuse is available at your local comic or bookstore and at online retailers everywhere. Go to anthonyjohnston.com where you'll find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It is the best way to spread the word about the show and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I wasn't joking when I said, honestly, like, nobody else that I know even remembers this series, let alone is able to talk about it with me.
Yeah, I think I don't, like I said, I don't know, like, people have just sort of been playing along with the joke for so long with me now that I start to think, how many people have actually watched this? I know that my cohort on RFS, Warren, has watched it. Maybe once. Like, he didn't tape it or obsessively watch it in his, you know, like I did. But apart from that, I honestly have never had a conversation about Star Cops with anyone until this very day. So
yay!
This has been very, very cathartic for me. It's very nice.
Yeah, Bert Kwok is like the British equivalent of Lou Diamond Phillips. We'd refer to Lou Diamond Phillips as Rent and Ethnic. Because he basically plays anything that isn't anything from the American continent that isn't white. Lou Diamond Phillips has played it at some point.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I haven't realized that. Oh God.
And yeah, Bert Kwok is the same over here for anything from East or Southeast Asia. Bert Kwok's played it basically.
Mm-hmm. And somebody made a good point on, I think it was on the Wikipedia page or somewhere, but that. They scheduled it at like 8:35, which for an hour long show is stupid because you know, there were no half hour long shows starting at 8. So you basically had to not watch something at 8 o'clock because you'd have to turn over halfway through to watch Star Cops and then come back and then, you know, be halfway through something else. So yeah, it was the worst scheduling, worst.
Well, and also hope that people didn't turn over for the 9 o'clock news on BBC One.
So that was a big thing at the time too, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, huge. Like now we all have our news at 10 o'clock. Or have they moved back since? Do you know, honestly, I can't remember because we have 24-hour news channels now, so it's not so important. But at the time, yeah, everybody tuned in to either BBC or ITV for the 9 o'clock news. So, yeah, scheduling a drama, of all things, to clash with that was just, yeah, that was a bad idea.
I know. It just shows to you that what the BBC and science fiction was like in those days,
well,
you know?
Yeah. Ask Buffy fans about that, yeah.
Oh, what? Did Buffy not...
UK? Buffy was shown on BBC Two in the UK, and I think they started out showing it at like 6 p.m. or something. Really weird time. And it's not the only series, by any means. There have been X-Files as well. That was another one that they screwed around with the schedule. Basically, they used to, I don't know whether they maybe didn't understand the value of having a show in the same time slot every week, or whether they just didn't care because, oh, these are sci-fi shows, so nobody's watching them anyway. But the BBC Two in particular has a long history of screwing around with the schedules of sci-fi and fantasy shows, much to the annoyance of the fans.
I'm so glad that Doctor Who isn't that way. Though oddly, it's I've always just thought it odd when, you know, when's Doctor Who airing this week? Okay, it's like 6:40, and then 6 o'clock the next week. Even like now, Doctor Who, the BBC's flagship show, up until this year, I think, which is relatively stable at like 8 o'clock or something like that. It's sort of like it was always on Saturday night, but it was never at the same time every single week. And I, you know, as a North American viewer, it's just flummoxes me. I don't understand how the British schedule their shows sometimes at these weird times of 6:40, you know?
It is crazy. Well, partly it's in recent years on Saturday nights as well. It's because Doctor Who either immediately precedes or immediately follows Strictly Come Dancing, which is like the biggest show on the BBC when it's in season. So, and that's different length according to how many contestants are left in the competition. So they change they literally change the length of that show from week to week.
No,
so
I understand
that. Yeah, so that makes a difference. But even so, I agree. It's even with everybody has iPlayer and DVRs and stuff now, even so, it is still very odd that they don't just pick a time slot and stick to it.
I know. It's frustrating for, you know, because we like to watch it live on BBC One now through VPN and such like that. We used to download it and everything, do that whole rigmarole and avoid the internet for 3 or 4 hours until we had a chance to watch it. Now we can actually watch it live, which is nice, but I've seen the end of Strictly Come Dancing far too many times to be, you know, like, oh, just end it. I don't care about the phone numbers. I don't care who's voting for. I just want to watch Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. It's weird how you know, in the States, you know, if a show... It's just like opening weekend at the box office. If a show doesn't like get like good overnight viewing figures their first night, boom, that's it. Cancel the show. You know, even though they made like 13 episodes after, nope, done, kill it. It's so we don't have this chance to sort of have these shows that are fondly remembered, you know, because the BBC commits to them. They don't cancel it. They cancel it once, you know, after the first series. But if they are paying for a whole series of episodes, damn it, they are going to air every single episode.
They are
going to
broadcast them, yeah. what that happened last year with, it was the remade Ironside.
Oh, really?
Yeah, American series. Which actually had quite a bit of pre-release hype over in the States. You know, I remember when I was at New York Comic Con and I saw huge billboards around Times Square for it, you know, and those aren't cheap. So clearly the network were getting behind it. And Ironside obviously is a, you know, much loved property, as it were. Everybody remembers Raymond Burr and Ironside. And I remember being skeptical. I was quite skeptical. But then they started showing it over here on Channel 5 or 5 USA. They get a lot of the American network shows, especially crime shows. And I was really impressed by how good it was. I was genuinely expecting to think like, oh, you know, no good. They've ruined it by rebooting it and stuff. But actually, it was really good. And then suddenly we heard that it had been cancelled in the US. And not only cancelled, but they had only broadcast something like 5 episodes out of 7 or 8 that they'd already made. So we, over here, actually saw more of that series than audiences did in the US. Because in the US, it was so poorly received, or so poorly reviewed, I should say, that they yanked it off the schedules as soon as they could. Whereas over here, they were like, well, we've got another 3 episodes, we'll just show them, we don't care.
Okay, well, I can't be as proud as all that then, can I?
It's just you.
Yeah.
Just you, the last man in the world not watching a dancing competition.
Yeah, it's not a Canadian thing, let's put it that way.